Welcome back, everyone, to the live stream here on Channel 9. For everyone that's watching, good to see you. Thank you for joining us and continuing on this Dev Connections. I'm actually in the co-located conference known as IT Edge Connections. My name is Rick Claus, and I'm going to be talking to you today about a little thing that's called tweaking performance and improving the availability of your Azure virtual machines. Just in case any of you guys out in the audience want to get a hold of me at some point in the future, send me emails or any kind of questions. You don't have a chance to ask the question because we got so many people just lined up in here to see this. I would suggest probably connecting with me in one of these different locales. You can reach me easily on @RicksterCDN on the Twitters. You can catch me on email at rclaus@microsoft.com and then also at regularitguy.com. However, if you're here at the conference and you want to try to track me down, just look for the guy with the green hat. And that's generally the easiest way to find me, because I typically always wear the green hat when I'm here at the conference. But I was upstairs talking with some of the dev guys just recently, and we were sharing some exchanges of different things that they were talking about with different projects that they've been involved on. And one of the things that came up was different projects that people they've been working on have conversations usually around the priority of how things get done. So when you're tasked with an IT project, it's typically going to be, first of all, make it work, regardless of what it happens to be, if it's an infrastructure project or if it's a development project for a new app. The second thing is make it so that it's working correctly, so it's architected correctly and has all the proper components to it. And then the third thing is then eventually look at making it fast. And I said, can you qualify that for me? Can you explain to me a little bit about what that's talking about? And they said, well, typically a lot of times I just go through the architecture piece when we're designing the app and specing it out before we start doing different sprints, and we're just drawing on the experiences of the different infrastructure folks and the different developer folks in the room about how they have deployed things in the past, which might have been on-premises, might have been in the cloud, might have been a hybrid environment, but they just go with whatever works, because that's just to make it go back to your very first point, which is make the overall project work in the first place. Nowadays, they're being tasked with more problems that get added into it as well. The next one is make it secure, because obviously if it's going to be on the public cloud, you want to make sure that's secure. And then also make it cost effective, which is an interesting one, because now, you know, you can't just go out and pick the biggest, baddest machines in the public space and your different cloud providers and then assume it's going to be the fastest possible. You actually have to choose the right level and the right balance. And so that's part of what I'm going to be doing today to be able to try to help you out and try to fix that up. Now, if you were watching the live stream earlier, or if you were in the keynote room earlier on, you saw Jason Zander, Corporate Vice President, responsible for Azure, going through a whole bunch of different sort of stuff. I have a couple of shared slides that were pulled from the same source presentation. It's always fun coming up after the keynote and realizing that a good chunk of your slides are already being used inside the keynote. But I've got a different bit of a spin and a different sort of approach to some of how those slides were delivered and some of the content that's on there. So my agenda I'm going to be covering off today, in loose form up here, is going to be quite simple. We're going to be talking about the different family of machines. Then we're going to be following that up with ARM templates and what they are, how they work, and why you should care as someone that works in the dev world or someone that works in the infrastructure space. We're going to be talking about availability sets and what you can do to design for them and some pros and cons to how they work, effectively using different types of drives and storage, and then also finally wrapping it up with a little bit of scale sets. I'm going to be kind of sticking to my comfort area of infrastructure as a service, because that's primarily my background. I was the guy that kind of sat in front of the computer 25 years ago to jiggle the cable to get the printer to work, and evolved gradually throughout the different roles as an IT administrator all throughout those years, going through land admin, sysadmin, help desk guy, looking after wide area networks, looking after network connectivity, designing data centers, designing applications and stuff like that up until the latter years of my career as a consultant. And so I'm bringing a lot of that knowledge back into the conversation again. I typically get called into customer visits with different customers of Microsoft when something's not working right, and they want to have some whiteboarding and some discussion around some different options before they go in and call in the really big guns of the premier field engineers or the network guys or something like that, because I can usually end up fleshing a lot of the issues out quite easily. And so when we designed data centers and when we designed Azure, made it available as infrastructure as a service, we already had this PaaS offering for platform as a service that then kind of was at the top of the stack and is now working its way down to infrastructure as a service. I got involved with Azure around the time when infrastructure as a service was in its second iteration, when you could have persistent disks that stuck around and you could have, in my opinion, a more useful version of IaaS you could go off and use. And so over those years, you know, we're talking four or five years, where our infrastructure for compute inside of our data centers has evolved throughout the different years for different types of offerings. We started off with shared instances and then basic instances or standard instances for the A series. We've introduced the D series machines, that sort of stuff, and we've kind of been evolving. Now you can step back and think about that for a minute as a natural evolution of how you have to cycle through hardware inside of your own shops. We have to do that, but on a scale of 24 regions, data centers that can have upwards of 600,000 compute cores. And so we have to gradually stage these different things in, otherwise there'd be a very large capacity of systems available on eBay to be able to reclaim as used systems that are out there. So like any large public provider, we have to go through a stage process to be able to go off and get these different machines out there. We're also trying to be very mean and lean to bring exactly what the customer wants at different times to get different levels of performance from a machine perspective, and also different price points. So I'm not here to kind of tell you, throw everything into the cloud, it's going to save you tons of money and that sort of stuff, and move it from CapEx to OpEx and stuff like that. I'm here for a bit of the reality check into that kind of conversation. And you can see the range of families that we've now evolved from. The A series were the very first ones that are out there, Intel, AMD, kind of entry-level type systems, really good for test dev environments. It could be used for prod for a not terribly compute-intensive instance if you wanted to. They have basically what we call the highest value. There's specialty versions of those different systems that are designed for high-performance compute and that sort of stuff, or have high-performance networking between the different nodes inside of our data centers. But that's generally the A series family for the highest value. Just around a year ago, almost a year ago, coming up in the springtime, we introduced the D-Series machines. The D-Series machines were the ones that came out that literally had a 50% in performance improvement over top of the A's for what we were saying, because we started using the latest generation Intel processors at the time, and we also introduced local SSD drives on the blades that are actually running the fabric that the VMs are brought onto. So you'll see a little bit later on when I go deeper in discussing about VMs and their architecture, where this local SSD comes into play from a performance perspective. That's our D-Series machines. Then we came out with, not too long ago, the G-Series machines. They were so awesome we had to jump over top of ENF to get the G. There is supposedly some kind of mythological tie to a reptilian monster that I can't name because of copyright reasons as to why we call them G's as well. But they're currently some of the largest systems that are out there inside of the market today from the public cloud perspective for CPU sizes and memory sizes. And then also this lovely thing that's known as SSD-backed storage, which is our IOPS for premium storage stuff. Now, this literally comes down to, and this is a leapfrog game, currently we're in the lead as far as the spec of the machines, and I have to qualify that by saying today is October 22nd? 29th? Is it 29th already? Oh wow, where'd the time go? October 29th. Currently we are the largest with our G-Series, and I'll talk about that guy in a bit more detail coming up as far as the public cloud is concerned. Now these new DV2s that are coming out, think of this again as some hardware refreshes that are going out. They're going to be available in select regions, eventually in more regions and more regions as customer demand comes up. They have about a 20 to 30% increase in performance, 30 to 35% increase in performance over top of the existing D-Series machines that are in the system right now. And so we're calling them, you know, I guess the naming police came out and said, let's make this really obvious, DV2 as a version 2 of the D-Series machines. You'll start to see those available in different regions as you start to go off and deploy them in the not too distant future. And then Jason, Mr. Zander, talked about the N-Series machines, which came out currently in private preview as the most powerful GPU accelerated VM that you can now purchase inside the public cloud for those different compute things. Now, I still haven't been authorized to use these guys yet, so I can't tell you the actual specs and how the performance goes on them, but these are some state-of-the-art NVIDIA GPUs that are available now inside the public cloud that are even CUDA compatible, so I'm looking for them to be able to see what I can do with some video editing and streaming, but they're ideally designed for AutoCAD and for other high computational type stuff. So the big thing you'll see in the big top there with the scale highest value on the left-hand side and largest scale up. Think of that also as dollars as well, for what it costs to be able to use these. And so that's where one of those things you get asked when you're doing a deployment project or a development project, where it says make it cost effective, that's where it comes into play. Don't just automatically assume you can go and spin up a bunch of G's to be able to get your systems done, because there are probably more cost effective ways to be able to go in and to edit and use these guys. So let me talk just a little bit about these G-series. Jason alluded to them inside of his keynote earlier on. The G-series, the awesome machines that they are, they're available in certain different regions. They're not available in every single region. You literally find out the easiest way of doing this, if you want to, through the user interface, of deploying a new machine, choosing a region you want to deploy to, and then check the size options. And if a G is available, you're able to go off and to use it. If not, then you can't use it. Now, because I'm a hardware geek and a server hugger guy, I had to go and take a look at the specs. The G5 currently has 448 gigs of RAM on that box. It currently has 7 terabytes of local storage space, approximately. That is all SSD-based. It has 32 CPU cores, and those are not hyper-threaded cores that are fractions of a core. Those are actual cores you get access to. We don't jimmy the math to be able to get more cores that actually are going to perform not as fast as these ones are, as some other vendors do. And the big thing is 64 attached disks. Remember that number, 64 attached disks, because one of the bottlenecks that I'm going to be talking about coming up is how to get more performance out of your drives and out of your disks that are attached. 64 is the most that we actually allow to attach. Now, I went to a friendly hardware site and did a spec out of what it would cost for me to build one of these machines of semi-equivalent specs and have it ordered and delivered to my office. Obviously, my boss did not approve that particular purchase, but he did approve me being able to spin up a G machine inside of Azure to be able to try it out. And this was, again, don't hold me on the price here, because this was just from the Dell website as an example. For a similarly spec'd machine with 32 cores, multiple Intel processors, multiple gigs of RAM to be able to make it so they had 448 gigs of RAM, it came out to, if you can see up there, let me make this bigger for you here. There you go. $66,000 before you discount it. And that's rolling out. This does not include shipping. That comes out. And we all know if you actually buy a system, you end up paying approximately 3 times the cost over the lifetime of that box with depreciation to be able to power it, to cool it, to store it inside of your data centers and stuff like that. So you're looking at close to $180,000 over the lifetime of that system running 24/7 inside your data center. The part that kind of struck me the most was that. I order it, I give them my IO number, I get approved from financials to be able to go off and get it. It's going to take 11 to 15 days to show up. If I had actually gone to the Azure portal and provisioned one when I started to talk about the G family, it would already be spun up and ready for me to use right now. And the neat thing is that it would have only started to accrue any cost against my account approximately 10 minutes after it started and actually is up and running, and the clock starts working. If you go and try to provision a G-series machine, again, just from manufacturer retail sales pricing as far as what it is, it's going to cost you approximately $6,500 a month, which is 744 hours of billable time. Worked out to the number of minutes, it's going to cost you about 13 cents a minute to run this box. Not bad. However, if you only run it when you need it and then turn it off again, and then turn it on when you need it again, and then turn it off again, because you're using proper modern infrastructure style of how you go off and manage your systems, you end up getting it at a much more fractional value in price, but you get all the same performance. So I had one of these guys spun up earlier today. I get nervous whenever I spin them up, so I like to spin them down very quickly just to still see that I still can. It's kind of like checking your badge at Microsoft to see if the door opens. Same kind of thing, if I can still bill against my subscription to see if it's all okay. So where things come into play as far as an architect is concerned and reviewing different designs that I've been involved with so far is it comes down to people not really thinking in the more modern way, more efficient way of how they're provisioning resources. If you're on premises, you're provisioning resources You don't really care because you've already made the capital purchase. You've got the hardware that's sitting there not being used inside your system. You just say, give me a VM, make it this much RAM, and then give me lots of disk space on it. I'm going to trust that the infrastructure folks that are providing that to me are going to do their best due diligence to get me the fastest possible disk backing that guy, and they're going to give me the most amount of compute and the most amount of RAM available to it. When I'm providing these services or purchasing these services from a cloud provider, I need to go in and be more cost conscious around that and choose exactly what I want. And so where things come into play with regards to this particular slide is knowing the fine details inside of the environment around what things cost and where the bottlenecks are. Because we put different limits inside of our systems to be able to make sure that everyone has access to the resources, we're not impacting other people, and we've got different safeguards in place. But that means that we have to put some kind of restrictions or governors around that, where we give you up until a certain point, and then we kind of cap where you're at, until maybe you go up a higher price point in a machine, or something along those lines. And so this slide here is talking about knowing your limits for what's known as the service manager infrastructure. Service manager infrastructure is the older way of doing things, but I thought I would at least bring it up just so you can take a look at what some of these limits used to be like. But I'm not going to spend any time on it because really, you don't worry about that guy anymore. You should not be deploying new services inside of Azure today using the old-fashioned service manager environment. You should really be using, for as much as possible, where the services are available, using what's known as resource manager, or ARM, Azure Resource Manager infrastructure, as opposed to classic or service manager ones, because that's basically using the new APIs, has access to the latest and greatest stuff, and is available for you to be able to go off and to use. And so what I will do is, I wanted to at least show you guys, I'm going to copy this off here, copy the hyperlink, bring up my Azure portal, and where is it? Let's go in and do this again. Bring this guy up. Copy that. Bring him in. This article is probably one that I have at quick touch, at quick hand, whenever I start having discussions around service limits. As you can see, it was last updated on August 29th. URLs inside the presentation, you guys can download that after the fact. But in here, it is a very large article that basically talks about all the different types of limits that exist inside of Azure that can potentially end up being bottlenecks or choke points on your design. This is, again, one of those things where usually when I get involved in a project or if you're in any kind of dev project, your priority is make it work and then make it right, and then potentially when someone tells you or you don't think it's currently performing to where it should be, that's when you start to dive deeper into looking into different things as the current methodology that we all use. From a timing perspective, we just don't have time to be able to keep up with it. This guy here will go through and explain every single nitty-gritty detail around subscription limits, bandwidth limits, core limits, that sort of stuff that exist inside of your area. I've got this covered in a slide that's coming up in just a little bit, but they do impact your systems, and they do impact performance, as you'll see in just a little bit. So that URL, still very relevant. It gets updated as new things come out. So I'm going to transition here and talk a little bit about resource groups and talk about why they're important. They've been around for a while. They became more relevant in my world, in the infrastructure world, around the May timeframe. The May timeframe of last year, this past May, basically is when they started to work with resources like infrastructure as service, compute resources, storage resources, networking resources, and we've been adding in more and more services into working with resource groups and resource manager ways of deploying things. Basically, as you can see, it's a grouping that you're able to use within your subscription, put all the different resources inside of it for a particular project, and then you can delegate out control with role-based access control to who is allowed to work with and manipulate those different objects. All the changes are audited, so you can track and see what's been changed and who changes them. You can also go in and get very granular so that you can even go and say only certain people have access to certain resources within those resource groups. And you can even, on a very large scale, make multiple nested resource or multiple components of your project as different resource groups to be able to delegate out permissions even on a finer grain basis. The one thing that comes up mostly for me on an IT pro perspective, infrastructure perspective, is the last part, billing and tagging. You're able to tag resources inside of Azure Resource Manager groups and the resources themselves with certain tags that you completely define. But the important part is those tags are revealed in things like billing information. So you can actually find out what those different projects that you're running inside of your subscriptions inside of resource groups are actually costing you to find out if there's cost overruns or things like that. So they come into play. So I'm going to pull back into that one document that I had up earlier, that web link, and talk mainly about some limits that exist right now for Resource Manager. The first thing I want to talk about is obviously cores. If you're trying to spin up a G5, that has 32 cores. By default, you can't spin up a G5 in a single region where it is unless you actually go and extend the number of cores that you're allowed to have by default inside of that region. So by default, you have 20 per region. It can go up to over 10,000 per region. All it requires is a simple support ticket that you say, yes, I'm aware, I'm going to be charged more for cores. Please give me more core access inside of this particular region. And then you can do it specifically on different regions where you might have to have this kind of information there. So that's a big thing that comes up when people are going beyond the simple dev test pilot mode and want to start going into production, and they hit a barrier with having failed deployments because they have no more core allocations left. Very simple thing to be able to fix is simply having to have that come up. Co-administrators, they can have unlimited numbers. The next thing that comes up is storage accounts for 100 is the default limit. Now, why is this important? From an infrastructure perspective, you have to put your disks inside of a storage account. Your disks each have limits, which you find out about in a couple of slides, for the maximum number of IOPS or transactions that are taking place against that particular disk. And we cap that at a certain limit to be able to make sure that we have enough resources for all of your services and all of our other partners and customer services. And so you actually sometimes need to design very large projects across multiple storage accounts and actually almost treat them as if they are, you know, this is my low intensity drive storage account, I can fit more in there. This is my high intensity workload, OLTP workload I'm trying to work with, so it's a very dedicated storage account. You're not charged more for more service account, for more storage accounts. It's the same amount no matter how many you happen to have. It's the data inside of those that you get charged against from the objects perspective. And so I've come across an issue where people have gone in and designed the physical location of the drives from their VMs being intermixed across the storage account, and they're hitting a bottleneck. The barrier starts coming into play because there's a 20,000 IOP limit on a standard storage account. So knowing that you have 100 of them by default inside of your account, when you get into large projects, you can always have that increase, which is good. Resource groups, you got 800. Number of API calls per hour, those don't really come into play. The next one down, second from the bottom and the bottom one there is what I already alluded to. The first one is how many VMs you can have inside an availability set. I'll talk about availability sets coming up. But basically, it ensures that when maintenance is taking place and we have to do something to the underlying fabric, we're going to move those different systems around. The availability set-wise, it actually is if there's a failure inside of different components of our fabric, that we make sure that your machines are spread across that, so there's less chance of your overall service going down. And then, as I mentioned at the very bottom, a 20,000 IOPS standard storage account limit of 20,000 IOPS exists. We cannot increase that. It is on a per storage account basis. So that was basically the rough outline of the families and the machines and the nuances that you need to be aware of when you're doing your design stuff. Coming up here is Azure Resource Manager templates. I did a discussion with ARM templates in a session I did yesterday, talking about designing your administrative workstation for managing Windows Azure systems. And ARM templates, I was surprised with the number of devs that were in the room. is not something that they don't intuitively think they need to worry about using in any great detail. They just take a basic one, they use it, and then they just go and code against it, and they deploy their system. But ARM templates are something that is a very interesting way you can start to think about now having your infrastructure come into more of a modern way of thinking things, more of a DevOps ways of thinking things, where you have your entire definition for your infrastructure inside of your project and also controlled by source control to make it so that you can now go and redeploy, do your tests against the different infrastructure and the different deployments that you've done, and then always know it's going to be deployed the exact same way. And so ARM templates can be used by the infrastructure folks ahead of time to understand how they work. You literally define every component that you require, the networking, the subnets, the ACLs that are on, the ACLs that are on the different networks, the protocols that are allowed to talk to different machines. You can control all of that, and that's also another gray area or background area that could end up putting a bit of a bottleneck on your system, is if you have, for instance, networking controls in place, and you don't have a full document of what's involved for those different networking controls, and potentially you're choking yourself down with too many different choke points. You deploy, manage, and edit ARM templates, either from Microsoft Azure in the portal, you can do it from GitHub, you can do it from a command line with PowerShell or the Azure CLI. You can also do it from Visual Studio as well if you go ahead and check into it. But it goes down and Resource Manager looks after provisioning all this different stuff and then finally goes down and includes hitting the appropriate APIs to be able to go in and to manipulate, create, change, and do other stuff to the different resource providers down below. Now, the one upselling point about ARM templates and knowing about them from an infrastructure perspective is that in the future, when we release and make available to you the Microsoft Azure Stack, which is your on-premises version of being able to do resource manager configuration and deployment of your compute resources, your storage networking resources, and other things along those lines, the same ARM templates that you could use up inside of Azure potentially could also work down on your own on-premises systems as well. So if you haven't spent a lot of time, you definitely want to look into Azure Resource Manager templates and what they are and what they can do. From a performance perspective, I talk about ARM templates mainly because they control what is going on with regards to every single piece of your infrastructure. So this is where you're going to have the VMs identified, the VMs positioned inside the different infrastructure that you're using, as well as the size of those VMs and the configuration of those VMs, including what disks are being used and what disks are being attached. And so inside those templates, you're going to literally identify which storage account is being used, which blob inside that storage account is going to be used for the VHD file, and other things along those lines. So ARM templates come down, and they generally are your friend for being able to keep track of all this sort of stuff. So with Azure Virtual Machines and with ARM templates, the big thing you can do is, from a deployment perspective, be able to make it so that you can deploy multiple machines simultaneously in parallel inside of your environment. This is where I'm going to take a break for a second and jump into a little quick demo here that I wanted to show you here in the portal from a deployment perspective. So I've got a friend on the Azure documentation team. His name is Ralph Squalis, or Squalachi, has gone through, and he's one of the documentation guys. He's actually based out of San Francisco. He's got a great page that actually has a good example of being able to do a deploy of VMs. So this particular template I'm going to be using is going to deploy n number of VMs very, very quickly in parallel. In the past, if I wanted to deploy 20 VMs using the standard Service Manager interface, it would literally take hours to go and deploy because the calls are happening sequentially for each individual one that you're trying to deploy. Now, using ARM templates with Resource Manager, you're able to go ahead and have it deploy multiple in parallel. So I thought I would at least kick off this deployment and show you this actually in action right now to see just how fast we can go off and deploy 20 VMs by default. So it's already authenticated me to the portal because I was already logged in. It's now allowing me to edit the parameters that are there inside of that JSON file. So I'm going to call this guy my admin username of Rick, my super secret password I want to use, storage account name, this is one thing that I do want to call out for one second. You need to know the nuances of the pros of what's involved with Azure behind the scenes. I happen to remember, and I got burned in this before, that your storage account name has to be all lowercase, and can't include funky punctuation marks and dashes and dots and periods and stuff like that. So keep it simple and make sure that's unique inside of your account. I'm just gonna go with 20. I'm gonna choose West US because that's what's closest to us. I say, what the heck, I'll go with a D series if I wanted to, a D1. And in this case, I'm using a very small Linux image from Canonical with Ubuntu server, long-time servicing engine number 14 from a version perspective. This will go ahead and say OK. I'm going to choose a new resource group and make one up here. DevCon IT Edge. And I need to review the legal terms, make sure we all read these terms in full detail, like I just did. Hit create, and have it go off, kick off my deploy, and off it goes. That system right now is going in, and if I actually go in and take a look at that, it should already have the resource group created. There we go. And then looking down here, you can see IP addresses are already coming in. I've got an availability set already coming in. And if I take a look at it, all sorts of NICs are already there. I've got public IP addresses, and this is going in the background, continuing to go. More and more stuff's gonna come in. But in the past, using Service Manager, that would have taken an iterative for an X loop, if you will, to do each individual one before it was done to go on the next one. So definitely way, way faster. By the time I'm finished the next check of my slides, it probably is already gonna be finished. But basically, it's massive and parallel deployments now possible with using Resource Manager from a template perspective. Good reason to go off and to use it. The neat thing, as you'll see here, is we'll automatically, I asked for this particular design, that all 20 of them, get placed inside of a availability set. The availability set is going to automatically carve itself up into a grouping of three groups of nine-ish machines each. Smaller than that because it's only 20. Six and change machines each. My math is really slow because I only had one cup of coffee today. So each one of those groupings are going to be called Fault Domain 1, Fault Domain 2, Fault Domain 3. And the idea is when we do a servicing update on the fabric underneath the system, Fault Domain number 1 will be the ones that are taken down first. 2 and 3 are still going to be running, so you still have a balance of machines available and still providing services. And then when we're done servicing the fabric on that particular area, we'll bring those other guys back up again. We'll then go and take down the second update domain and restart the first one, and then so on and so on. So fault domains come into play. We now can do custom URLs and custom script extensions that come out of them for additional configuration. The one that I chose doesn't have any. We also can use SSH version 2 RSA format support for keys for being able to go in and to log in and to work with those different VMs. So definitely some big improvements with how we're doing the API v2 stuff on the system. So the ARM templates come in and they're described in what they call a JSON file. Now again, from an infrastructure guy's perspective, when I think of JSON, especially around the time of Halloween, I think of the murder guy that goes and kills people. And sometimes JSON files can be just about as scary as the axe-wielding murderer known as JSON that's out there. Mainly because from an infrastructure perspective, we don't have as many tools as some of the dev guys do with the plugins available with Visual Studio to very nicely go off and to see all those different resources. So you get used to looking at this from a texting perspective for the basic areas that come out of the JSON file. The very first one is simply the schema that tells you, you know, what schema are we using, what's the format of the JSON file for the different elements that we're looking for, and more importantly, what version are we looking for that particular schema. Then we talk about parameters. Parameters are the ones that basically can pop up inside of the form that you have to fill out to be able to answer, to be able to customize the deployment that you need to have. In this case, you've got the standard stuff with what storage account name are you going to use, what administrative name are you going to use, what password are you going to use for that user account on that virtual machine. Then you've got the actual variables that are quote-unquote hard-coded that will always be used. This is where I can find a lot of stuff in here where I could go off and tweak myself. So if I wanted to, instead of giving the user the ability to simply pick a machine of class of speed of machine from a family perspective, I can come in here and edit it directly under VM size as an example, which is currently a standard A2 to go off and make those changes. And then finally, you also have the resources that are listed out that actually get deployed. Here you've got an example here of a public IP address being assigned, which stored account is being assigned. In this case, it's a variable that's going to come up for a storage account name. And then finally, you also have the ability to have default values that can be populated. In this case, it's default values for an OS that's in there. So JSON files, ARM templates, and everything along those lines from an infrastructure and from a performance perspective. There are areas in there where once you've decided how you want to have stuff deployed and what you need to tweak inside those different systems, put it inside the JSON file, put it inside the ARM template, so you know it's always going to be deployed the same way. Sure, you can go through and start off with the portal or start off with some basic ideas, but make sure that as things change, you update your JSON file and you update your templates for future revs of different things. And obviously, if you're using Visual Studio, check this into the code to make it so it can be part of your source control. So coming into availability sets. Availability sets. We used to have a limit of how many machines were inside a single availability set because there was a limit of the number of machines you could have inside of what's known as a cloud service. Cloud services are basically deprecated now as far as we're concerned because we don't use the same terms anymore inside of Resource Manager. But the concept is that you have to have at least two machines providing the same service inside of your architecture design inside of an availability set to be able to get take advantage of our 99.95 SLA. It's in there. And so example here would be simply a primary SQL database and a secondary SQL database that's on there, and they're nice and happy. That technically meets our SLA of 99.95. You have to obviously design this into your applications and your architecture to have systems that are available and responsive inside of something like an availability set to provide services in case one or multiple of those machines go down. This applies regardless if it's Windows or Linux. Now, looking at this from a hardware perspective, inside of our data centers of hundreds of thousands of cores that are out there, you've got racks upon racks or containers upon containers of different systems that are out there. We have sections of the data center for our compute. We've got sections of our data center for our storage and that sort of stuff. On the compute side, an example, just to, it doesn't actually look like this, but this is a representation of what you can understand for this is, inside of a 48U rack, you've got obviously a power that's giving to that rack, you've got cooling to that rack, you've got networking switches to that rack. Those physical blades, those machines inside that rack, are running the fabric, and our VMs on the compute side are running on top of that fabric of those different machines. So, like Jason mentioned in his example a little bit earlier on, you've got possible failure areas, not just of individual blades. You've got failure areas of the power, and you've got failure areas of the possible switches that are inside of those racks. And so, if we look at this from an availability perspective, we've got thousands upon thousands of racks of compute power that's in there. When you go ahead and deploy inside of an availability set, in this case, we've got two or three of the things that's going on. You got two VMs, we're gonna sprinkle them across the racks, across power grids, and across networking grids as well, to make it so you got the best availability in case one of those guys happens to catch on fire, everything's still gonna continue to work. And so in this case, we will go ahead and once that particular rack has a fault and goes down for some reason, we'll restart that other machine on another rack someplace else inside of our data center to be able to make it so that your availability set is back up and happy again. So that's the concept of how availability sets works. With availability sets, the governing principles behind them is you have to have your compute inside of the resource groups inside the same resource group in order for it to be part of an availability set. You also, when you make an availability set, once you have multiple machines inside of it, we take care of the positioning of those machines across all the different fault zones inside of our data center. We look after that for you. But we also do things where instead of just having three fault domains that are taking place, we also have what's known as five update domains. So as we need to go through and update the infrastructure down below, we make sure that we only hit one of those update domains at any given time inside of your availability set. Update domains are for host maintenance, and fault domains are for physical isolation from different component failures inside of our different racks inside of our data centers. Inside of the availability set, you've got a maximum of 100 VMs that can sit inside of one availability set. And then finally, the last part is don't be silly and only deploy a single VM into an availability set. If you're doing a single VM for any given particular reason, you're taking the risk into your own hands from an architectural perspective that that machine will be rebooted or restarted during maintenance times. That will tell you ahead of time the maintenance window's coming, but that machine will go offline for a period of time and then be restarted someplace else eventually when the maintenance window is over. You won't have any SLA for that machine being up and functional. That's actually probably one of the biggest things I get called in to talk about, availability sets and how they work with update domains, with people that are just getting started with cloud environments, because again, they're used to having control of the fabric themselves on premises, and they're used to being able to control when different update windows and maintenance takes place, and maybe they can do a live migration if you're a Hyper-V box, or a vMotion if you're a VMware shop, to be able to move those things out of the way. We can't do that on the scale that we happen to have inside those data centers to be able to do that. So that's why we go with the public cloud provider methodologies of having update domains. So these are described with subscription limits and service limits. Again, URLs at the bottom of the page. You can download the slides and take a look at it yourself afterwards. But good to know that availability sets, when properly designed, can definitely be your friend to be able to help things out. One thing I will mention here on this as well is when you're going and designing this kind of stuff for your own on-premises environment, you generally don't think about the update domains and how they work and where they are. You just assume that your fabric is going to always be there for you, obviously, because you control it. But in the public guidance, in the public world, it doesn't actually fall in that same way. So I talked about ARM templates, infrastructure as code, the sizing of machines, which is one definite thing. But the next topic I'm going to talk about here is down to the lowest level of conversation around disk IOPS. The reason why that comes up is I'm pretty sure that any customer that I've gone off and talked to that are going through a development environment or a development project, they don't necessarily go down to the same level of discussion around how many IOPS is this particular query going to run against my database to figure out if I have enough IOPS available, because most people with their experience of working on premises, they don't care about that because it's already been figured out for them. You have to know that level of information when you're working inside the public cloud, because we place governors, if you will, around our disks to make it so that we don't overtax the system. You end up coming into a bottleneck, hitting, that's an invisible barrier of a governor that we put in place to make sure that you don't overrun the system. So stepping back and looking at the architecture of a VM, when you say new compute, make me a VM, what's actually happening in the background is you're filling out the form for information. Once you've filled out that form, you're going in and making the service APIs in the back end are going in and they are taking a VHD image out of storage, if you will. They're copying it down to a blade inside of our data centers, and then it gets laid out on a blade. The VM itself gets access to and deployed on top of the C drive, let's say, and then it also has access to a temporary disk. That temporary disk is laid out on top of the local, in this case, on the A series, or on the D series, it's going to be laid out on top of an SSD drive for temp files, and also is used for background caching. And then you also have the additional drives that are attached up, which are persistent disks. What this basically means is, when you're running and designing your apps, if they have to have any kind of local interaction with the hard drive, you're going to want to make sure that they're in a place that's either durable, because you have to survive a restart, or you design them so that you don't care about the IOPS and the data that's on there, because it can be recreated again very quickly or easily, in which case it could be a candidate to be on top of the temporary disk. The reason why is because when this machine is resized or stopped and deallocated and then started and reallocated again, it's not going to hit the same blade. It's going to hit a different blade inside of our infrastructure that's running the fabric, and you're not going to have access to that same drive for the temporary drive for where your data happened to be stored. So you can never rely on the fact that the temporary disk is actually going to be there, with the same temporary disk is actually going to be there. So I definitely want to call out that on the temporary disk, if you're using an A series, the D drive is what we call spinning rust. It is a magnetic disk that spins, and it's slow, and it basically is there as simply a temporary location. If it's a D or a G series machine, it is actually an SSD-based system, which is much, much faster, with caching as well that comes into play. That OS disk is coming from an Azure blob back inside of our storage network, And potentially, the additional data disks are also coming off of a blob storage as well, someplace else. So our storage architecture is separate from our compute infrastructure, and you actually have to run across the network to get to it. But as far as the host OS is concerned, it doesn't know that it's running across the network to get to it, because it's remotely mounted and copied down, potentially. So good to know that from an architecture perspective, because that reveals a bunch of possible issues with regards to performance. So for temp drives, as I mentioned this, never place critical information on that temp drive. It's only there for a very fast cache if you need it, but it is never guaranteed to be there because it is a non-persistent disk. So an example would be if you're going to be doing this from a SQL environment, you can absolutely go and put your tempdb and also your buffer pool extensions on those temp drives if you want. However, they are SSD based and they will not be there on the restart. You can basically go in, because I know SQL will throw an error message, if the folder structure doesn't exist on that drive for where it's supposed to be, it'll basically throw an error and not initialize correctly. So you can actually run a scheduled task inside of the machine to make sure that that folder structure is present, and then you won't have an issue with SQL trying to initialize that if that machine has to get restarted someplace. And then obviously, make sure this works. The easiest way to make sure this works is to resize your VM. So when I create a VM or resize my VM, I simply have to go in and change one parameter in the portal or through PowerShell that will go in and deallocate the system, increase the size from a D1 to a D5 or D6, and then redeploy again. And then it goes and it will physically move it to a different scale unit inside of our data centers. And so that's the easiest way to go through and to do that test. From a performance perspective, we've done some research to be able to publish what these numbers are. This was a blog post that came out back in 2014. It's still relevant and accessible today. The temp disk sizes, as far as the temp drives are concerned, listed there with a number of cores between 500 gigabytes all the way up to 800 gigabytes in size. Each one has a different level of maximum IOPS that are available for you to be able to go off and to have access to from a database perspective. And then also you got maximum reads and maximum writes. I don't see that much of a bottleneck come into play a lot of times when I'm discussing this with customers when it comes down to the temp drive. What I do see a lot of is the improper use of temp drives where they believe that it's going to be a durable storage that will be there during a restart, when in fact it absolutely is not. Now, the one part I didn't talk about with my storage architecture is what do I do for data that has to be persistent? You have to attach disks. If the OS disk is brought down off the blob and used on that particular blade, the data disks work in a similar fashion. They have to come from the Azure Blob Storage, and then on the local machine, they're attached up, the fabric abstracts it all, and you've got your E, F, G, H, I, J type of thing. Each one of those disks are going to have an IOPS limit placed on them to make sure that you have enough resources to be able to work with inside of your system. And so this way of manually mapping them onto the system can be done during the ARM template deployment phase, can be done after the fact, maybe it's done in a one-off if you're going to do it the old-fashioned way, to be able to go off and deploy those disks. Let me show you what that looks like and how actually easy it is to go in and to attach disks up and make more disks available. And let's also check back in here to see how my scale set is working here. You can see that, come back here. I have a good number of VMs already up and running. In this case, I've got all the way upwards of 18, 19 VMs that are now currently deployed and already to go. I can see these boxes are all part of an availability set. If I take a look inside my availability set, I can actually see that because I have so many machines, I do have 3 fault domains, I've got 5 update domains, and I had 20 machines currently running inside this availability set. Now, this was a generic template that has no automation after the fact. I'm not calling a DSC extension or a Chef extension to go off and do more stuff to these VMs. But they're basically ready to go and be deployed and be used in any kind of way, shape, or form that I want. Over here, if I go and take a look at these VMs, I'm going to go back to my other system that I have currently running inside my resource groups. I have is it this one here? No, that's the one I already created. IT Edge Connections. There we go. So this particular box is one I deployed last night to make sure it was already done. It's a standard D14, which means that it has 14, it's the highest we can get. It has 16 cores in total, 112 gigs of RAM. But I didn't pick a DS14. A DS versus a D means that a DS has access to use the premium storage of SSD back storage for more performance IOPS on the disks that I attach. This is just a standard D14 that was used in this particular guy here. I'm going to show you him in just one second for what you can do. But if I take a look at the other guy on my main page, which is my scale set guy, scale family. This particular guy here is DS2. It has 2 cores and 7 gigs of memory on that particular box. If I take a look at the size, I can see that it is allowing me to be able to go in and attach up to 4 disks. And of those 4 disks, because I have SSD capabilities, I can actually get upwards of 6,400 IOPS, provided I choose SSD-backed storage and I gang them together and then be able to stripe my data across those disks. That's basically how you get your performance, is striping them across the different disks. Pretty simple stuff. The way you do that is simply going to the disks area and say, attach a new disk. It automatically fills in the name. This size becomes important right here. Because of limits that exist, which I'll share with you in just a moment. So I'm just going to keep the maximum size of basically 1 terabyte in size. You can see right here what I'm alluding to, except I need to zoom in better. There we go. By choosing the largest guy in the system, the 1 terabyte drive basically, I can get 5,000 IOPS with that one disk times 4, 5,000 times 4, math. 20,000 IOPS can now happen with this particular set of machines for being able to do stuff. If I geared him down and only chose 512, or so half a terabyte in size, I'm now geared back to about 2,300 IOPS per disk that I can now attach into my system. So I'm gonna leave him at the highest one, give him the name, go ahead, hit okay, and it's gonna go attach. And then go ahead and attach the second one. I'm just going to take the defaults, hit attach. Okay, the first one didn't finish before I tried to attach the second one, so the auto naming convention didn't kick in. So let's do a refresh on this guy. There we go, there's the first one. There, it's a different name. Now hit okay. And he's attached in. We can see that it's still not quite done yet from attachment perspective. I think you kind of get the gist of it, but I at least want to get 2 of them in there so I can show you how I gang them together. To speed things up here, what I'm actually going to do is, if I jump back, you saw how easy it was to attach, and I go back to the other machine that I had, which is this guy. He already has all these disks attached inside of him. You can see I have all 32 disks attached inside of the system already. So if I go back in and I connect up to that box and log into them, because I'm doing this interactively as opposed to dynamically with a script that runs after the fact. There it is there. Let's connect up and sign in. Hope I remember my password from last night. This is a machine that's sitting inside of our data center on the East Coast. It's our D14, which is our largest non-G series machine that's out there. Yes. Good question. Basically, he was asking, am I being charged for the usage of the disk or the disk as a whole? I'm going to answer that in just 1 second, because I talk about disks and how we build them and how we work with them and the IOPS stuff in just a slide or two. So one moment, and I'll get you right back on that. So with Server Manager, just to make it nice and simple, I, of course, obviously could be doing this with PowerShell on the local box if I wanted to. I could also hit this box remotely and do PowerShell. I'm just going to go through and do the GUI environment. Once it kicks in and refreshes. Come on. When we look at this guy, here it is, it's slowly initializing. You can see that I have a temporary storage drive. That's my 7 terabytes of storage, and I've got my local C drive on the system right now. But inside of the file system, volumes and storage pools, you'll see that I've got all those disks are now available and visible for me to look at inside the operating system. I'm just going to go ahead here and make a new storage pool. Call it data to keep it simple. Choose all of my disks to include. Go ahead and create them. Once you've made the pool, you then go ahead and you make your disk. Once you've made your disk, you're basically laying down your protection pattern of how the data is going to be written across those disks. And this comes up in conversation a lot when I'm discussing this with customers, is what format do I use for that particular data disk protection? Do I do a RAID on that particular system, like a RAID 5 with striping with parity? Do I go with a mirroring partition with a RAID 0, or a RAID 1, sorry? Or do I go with a fast as possible striping with a RAID 0? And the answer to that is, we look after the disk failure for you automatically inside of our data centers. When you write one action to the drive, we're going to go in and take that write and make sure it permeates across multiple copies, 2 other copies, so basically 3 in total on the local data center at any given time. One of those 3 copies is going to be available. So if for some reason a storage area environment that had one of those drive writes not become available anymore, you still have 2 other copies of it that'll be used on the system. So the answer to that is basically go for as fast as you possibly can written across those drives, because you know that they're durable and that we're protecting them for you. Of course, it's lovely taking its time to finish writing the pool out on the system. Pardon me, question? The question is, how do you do your backups? How do you do restores? How do you do that sort of stuff? You would have to still protect the overall OS and everything else along those lines, like you normally would with a backup and restore routine. We actually make that available as part of Azure if you want to with one of our backup agents. So you can install a backup agent inside of your VMs. It's going to go ahead and back up on a regular schedule that you choose and use Volume Shadow Snapshots capabilities to be able to do that. And then you're able to restore the machine back again as you need. That's all just part of the underlying backup architecture that exists inside of Windows. There we go. Finally finished. Made the pool. Go ahead and make a disk. The wizard for the disk comes through and says, hey, here is my volume, or here's my pool. What do you want to call this? Data disk. And again, I'm just going to choose simple, which I would never actually use in my own infrastructure unless I have protection levels taking place at that side of things. But because I know that it's protected inside of Azure already, I'm just going to make it the maximum size. And go ahead and create it. When this is finally done as well, then I would go through and make a volume on top of that, format it with NTFS, and then go ahead and sign a drive letter, and then allow my applications to go ahead and to use this guy as required. So there's the volume coming up now. Go ahead and choose the format of it. I'm going to make it the same size. Give it a drive letter. Take the defaults. Hit create. It goes ahead and makes it and formats it in a quick format fashion, and then makes it available as far as caching is concerned. So it's all set and all good. I don't think you want to sit here and watch the rest of this progress bar going, so I'm going to let that guy finish up in the background and potentially come back to him in just a moment. So as I mentioned, when we write with standard storage, when we write our data across the data center with your VMs, we're obviously going to be having 3 copies of that particular page blob taking place. VHD files can basically have a 1 terabyte in size. You have, from a standard perspective, 500 IOPS that can take place. One write gets replicated across 3 different locations inside the storage array. And then potentially, if you decide to go with geo-replication, we also make sure that that data is replicated across different data centers in 2 different locations, should you want to be able to go off and to use that. That's going to be based on your scenario for how you want to ensure that data is protected and available in different locations. If you wanted to have access to that data in another location, you obviously have to have that built in with the way that your apps would access that particular data. The core nitty-gritty of this guy here comes down pretty simple. Spinning Rust disks are going to have a maximum of 500 IOPS that are available to them. The SSD-backed disks known as premium storage are going to have a 5,000 IOPS if you choose the largest one, and that's the if you choose. The P3, they're called, the P3 tier, is a 1 terabyte in size, 5,000 IOPS maximum. And the neat thing is, it's a 200 megabits per second network throughput that it gets to have access to it. If you go with a smaller disk, larger numbers, and you still find your IOPS is enough for you, you might end up with a network throttling being taking place between the VM and the storage space when you're doing your storage analysis. And so just be aware of that. And to answer your question with regards to are you charged for this, if it's a standard disk, which is spinning Rust, you only get charged for the bits that are formatted and laying at rest inside of that particular machine or inside that particular VHD file. So if you have a 1 terabyte drive and you only have 500 gigs of data on it, you're only going to pay for that 500 gigs. That's not the case for how we do it for premium storage. Premium storage, you actually pay for the total size because it is a premium. And so that's one consideration you have to worry about from a cost perspective, that you're going to be paying more for those P3s, and you're going to be paying for them whether they contain data on them or not. That's just the way that we do it. Now, VM size will affect the network speed and the caps to get to those storage. So the higher the VM, the more bandwidth it has to be able to work within the data center. Therefore, you may or may not hit your maximums with your bandwidths. So be aware of the VM size impacting your storage. But then the other caveat that comes into play is the maximum number of disks you could really theoretically have inside of a storage account. Storage account has size limits, but then it also has IOPS limits. You're going to hit the IOPS limit first for noisy disks. High-performant disks, if your standard storage, are going to come out to 500 IOPS per, 500 times 40 is 20,000. So that's basically the most you could possibly have. If you have OS disks as well as data disks inside the same storage account, you don't use your OS disk as much as you would your data disk. You could probably fit some more OS disks inside of that storage account. You also could simply have storage accounts targeted for specific roles. This one is my OS disks, this one is my main workload database storage account, this one is my secondary database storage account, to be able to isolate those IOPS to be within those different types of containers. This is getting down to the lowest level of architecture you can get to for planning out where your IOPS are going to be. The one thing that's not listed on this slide is the fact that I haven't talked about premium storage accounts. Premium storage accounts don't have a maximum IOPS level. You have a limit that you hit by the number of disks you can put inside of them. The largest disk that's in premium storage is a P3. That's 1 terabyte in size. A premium storage account can have up to 35 or 32 terabytes maximum inside of it. So basically, you can have 32-ish disks inside of a premium storage account. Do you remember what the G5 number of disks you could have inside of it? 64. So if you had a really mondo, awesomely massive, super high IOPS workload, you would actually have to have multiple premium storage accounts set up with all 64 disks populated across them to be able to ensure that you can reach your absolute maximum number of IOPS, because you'll hit the size factor before you hit the IOPS issue with that particular situation. Now, personally, I haven't ordered a machine as large as the G5 physically in quite some time. And likewise, I haven't had a workload that required that number of IOPS in quite some time in any of the cloud design options that I had. I did have plenty of people automatically defaulting and requesting large systems for their design projects that were in the G series just because they could, because that was the way that they were used to doing it. But you don't have to. You can actually architect it to go across smaller systems and get more effective use of your subscription resources. So this kind of brings me up to the last point before I leave a little bit of time for some questions. According to my clock that I've got running on up here, I've got about 10 minutes left, I do believe. And that comes down to scale units. So scale units are basically a unit of scale that we have inside of the data centers that you're able to, once deployed inside of that stamp of that scale unit, you basically are kind of, for lack of a better term, locked into that particular scale unit unless you deprovision and reprovision again at a different side. And so you might, if you happen to deploy to an A4, let's say, you might end up with yourself sitting inside of a scale unit number one, and that's as maximum as you're going to be able to be deployed within and resize your systems. But if you end up going into a scale unit number four, we have an A4 inside of there, but then you could also bump it up to a 5, 6, 7, or 8, or you could even jump over and switch from an A over to a D if you wanted to as well. The ease of how you're able to do that really comes down to, very simply, if I go back in here, look at that, he's still trying to format that volume. I'm glad I didn't wait for him. If I go back over here to my account, let me go back in, you know what, I'll do this guy here, why not? Choose all settings, there he is, under size. This guy's up and running right now. He currently is a D14, which is basically about as large as you can get on this particular guy for how he was deployed. And then you can see here, because I have so many disks attached to him, I can't take any of the smaller sizes. They're all basically all grayed out for every single one. Let's go back here to one of my other guys that I've got deployed for resource groups and choose scale family this time. Because this was a smaller box that I deployed earlier. He's only a DS2 right now. So if I take a look at size down here, I'll be able to go in and change my size of this guy to a bunch of different options. And you see they're all exposed here for me. I can go anywhere in the D family because he's already a DS2. And you can see here I can also go to a standard D if I wanted to as an option. I can also keep on going down, D11s. I can go down to an A if I wanted to. And even the A basics. But notice here that the new versions of the DS V2 series systems are not available on this particular system. We need to go off and deploy to. And then obviously the G series as well. So that's telling me that basically I know that from a stamp unit perspective, from a scale unit perspective, I'm probably inside a scale unit number four. If I went ahead and decided to jump inside a scale unit number five by deploying a G series, I wouldn't be able to fall back down to a smaller unit onside that system. I basically would have to destroy this machine, recreate them again with an Azure ARM template, and then choose a different unit number to be able to go in there. So, moral of the story is, if you think you need to have flexibility for particular deployments to change on the fly to different levels of scale units, just try to go up higher than an A4, and you're basically going to be guaranteed at a minimum to be inside of a scale unit number four, and you have the flexibility to go anywhere you want. But generally speaking, it's as easy as redeploying again anyway, but it's something to be aware of from the way that you look at your scale units to jump back and forth with different sizes. Obviously, you'll see other scale units that are going to be applying in there, which will be the new DV2s, and also will be the new N-series machines as well. So with that, I got some closing thoughts I wanted to kind of wrap up with, unless, of course, I'm still leaving some time for some questions, because we still have a couple of minutes here for questions as well. Number one, don't just grab a big hunk of compute and start to use it. That could work. It works fine inside of your dev test pilot deploys to get them up and started and working quickly. Focus on, like I talked about at the very beginning of this talk, making it work and then making it work right. And then worrying about making it go faster and make it work that way. But generally speaking, I've seen requests from different organizations, even within Microsoft, where they're used to working in an environment where they own the infrastructure and they just want to have the biggest, baddest possible thing, and they're only going to be using that particular resource, maybe 10, 15, 20% of the resources that are out there. It's much more efficient to tailor it down to the right level. Just don't go down so far that you end up restricting yourself with some of these bottlenecks. The bigger issue that you can now think about when you're developing these applications is, can I develop this so that I can use smaller multiple instance of machines that are cheaper and faster and run them in parallel, if you can re-architect that type of solution? When you're doing a lift and shift of applications, you generally don't have that flexibility, but when it comes time to do some review time to look at how you want to re-architect your solution, definitely look at how you can go ahead and spread the load across multiple machines from a scales perspective. It makes a lot more sense to be able to go off and to do that. Are you hitting your internal governors that are in place because of your subscriptions and your limits? The biggest one that I see people hit are the unknowns of the IOPS. Because generally speaking, you don't think about that when you're doing your main part of the build and deploy because you're just worried about getting it up and working. And generally speaking, you have control of your fabric on premises. And so these limits and IOPS don't come into play in that situation. They do inside of a public cloud environment. And so spinning Rust, 20,000 IOPS per storage account, 500 IOPS per disk. Gang your disks together to add them up to get roughly approximately that many IOPS out of each one of those disks. Don't worry about having to use a RAID deployment on top of that or a striping with parity. Just go with pure raw power. The same applies for Linux boxes as well, by the way. So that's the way to go. If you're looking at doing something on the premium storage side, you will incur more cost to it, but you're no longer shackled with having a 500 IOP limit, but then you have to choose a P1, P2, or P3. A P1 actually has the same 500 IOP limit on it. The P2 is a 2300 and the P3 has a 5000 limit on it, but it is larger. And you will pay for the entire size even if you don't have data on those individual drives. And then finally, are you designing and worried about your IOPS across your storage accounts? Are you throwing too many disks inside of the storage accounts and you're maxing out on those IOPS before you max out on the throughput of the individual drives, which is quite possible? You could potentially, as I mentioned, have maybe 65 disks inside of a standard storage account if they're low use, but you absolutely will max out on high use disks if you start hitting close to 500 max per, which equals your 20,000. And I do believe that's the last closing thought that I have, which leaves me with the questions slide. And I had a couple that were going on through the thing. I can take probably one or two. Don't all rush up and answer at the same time now, folks. There are no microphones, so just take your time, put up your hand one at a time if you have any questions that you wanted to have answered at anything. Anybody? Oh, look, the wave of hands are coming up now. Yes, sir. Will my slides be available? Absolutely, they'll be available. I pass them off in the speaker room to the speaker manager. She already has them. She's going to put them up on the website. For those of you that are watching live on Channel 9, I'm assuming they'll be available as well post-conference in some way, shape, or form. If not, you can always ping me, which is on my coordinates here by email, and I'll make sure that you get a copy of them if you want, but they could be kind of large. Yes, sir, you there in the blue. Great. Okay, so the question is, what is the best way to migrate from a classic style architecture that's already deployed in Azure over to a resource manager version up inside of Azure 2? For that one there, I'm going to have to say, hang on to your hats and just wait a little bit longer. We're working on a solution that's going to make it painless for you, for the most part, for the bulk of the people that currently have stuff deployed in Azure and Service Manager, to bring it over with no downtime over to the resource manager side. Wait a little bit longer. We're not ready to share that just yet, but I know that the blog article's in draft mode right now, and so we're very, very close to sharing that, but we're committed to making some kind of a migration path for you. Hang in there. Time for one more, last one. Yes, sir. Yep. Okay, question was basically, if you're running a web VM, a VM infrastructure as a service box that has a web interface on top of it, that's a web server, you want to go ahead and the load is too much, you want to go have a second and a third box that happens to do that, you can use our internal load balancing on certain families of machines on the IaaS side of things, up to 10 machines, I think, is the last time I checked what it was. That so long as they're identical and configured correctly, you basically can have an internal load balancer placed on those boxes for specific port requests, like port 80 as an example. It's that simple to do. But the apps have to be written in such a way that it can support it on the web interface that can go and talk to a common back end. So it does have to be architected correctly. But we absolutely support it. It's available in certain families to be able to make it work, and it's built in as far as IaaS. It's automatic if you're using PaaS. It's a bit more finicky if you're using the IaaS side of things. But with that, I got to say thank you very much. Please tip the waitress on the way out. Don't forget to do any evals you happen to have if you're using the event board application. I'd love to know what you thought about this and how it could possibly improve it. Those of you on Channel 9 that are watching this live, stay tuned. Coming up after the break is somebody else, I don't know who it is, talking about some stuff. But if you look further down the page, you'll see who's coming up next. Thanks a lot, everyone. It's been great. Cheers.